These giants had 6 fingers and 6 toes. This is common. We see it mentioned multiple times in the Bible.
Intelligent design and DNA. Scholars can't explain it all away. Get ready to be awed by the handiwork of God. Tune in to Real Science Radio. Turn up the Real Science Radio. Keeping it real.
Greetings to the brightest audience in the country. Welcome to Real Science Radio. I'm Fred Williams.
And I'm Doug McBurney. Fred, what do we have going this week?
Well, today we're going to talk about giants in the Bible. Are they real? Is there actual evidence for them? We have a special guest who's going to enlighten us on this fascinating topic. It's researcher, explorer, and author, Dino Dave. David Wetzel of Genesis Park, and that's genesispark.com. He's known for his field expeditions and his work compiling scientific and historical evidence for dinosaurs and man living together. And today he joins us to talk about giants. Welcome to the show, Dave.
Well, thanks so much. Good to be able to visit with you guys, Fred and Doug. And this is an exciting topic, one that people are very interested in. And I'm just thrilled to be able to share with you some of what my research has led me to and some of how the Bible and modern science can tie together and show that the Bible is more up to date than tomorrow's Google headlines.
Oh, I love it. And I love the fact that you start with the Bible and then you mention science after that. I really like that. So, you know, Dave, we've all heard about giants and the legends, not just from the Bible, but from cultures around the world through all of history. I've heard stories about alleged, you know, giant fossilized remains, some of them this big, some of them this big, some of them even really bigger. And so what's the truth behind these stories about giants? I want to know, and I know that you've been researching this topic for years. You've gathered some sources and material that I'm sure most of our audience has never heard of. I know it's going to be fascinating.
Well, guys, I wasn't terribly interested in giants several years ago, but I had somebody give me a book on it and said, you need to do some research on giants. Well, I'm a creation speaker. I talk about creation and evolution, science in the Bible, and my specialty is, of course, the dinosaurs. So I kind of set it aside thinking, well, it really isn't necessarily pertinent to the origins debate. And then I was doing a speaking trip to the St. Louis area, and I didn't have anything to read particularly, so I grabbed this book, and it's a book entitled The Ancient Giants Who Ruled America, The Missing Skeletons in the Great Smithsonian Cover-Up. Well, that sounds fun, right? So I thought, well, let me throw it in with my luggage and I'll read it along the way. And come to find out, as I was reading the book, I'm reading that the headquarters of this mound builder civilization is Cahokia. We'll talk more about this as we go. And Cahokia is in St. Louis. I'm flying into St. Louis to speak for the week. And so as God would have it, these things just kind of came together and I began to research this topic of giants.
Well, Dave, let's lay the foundation. So what do you mean by giants? I know when people hear the word giants, they imagine everything from cartoon characters to NBA players to the football giants. You know, I know you're up in New England. You apparently are a Patriots fan. We'll let you, that's okay for now. We'll still have you talk about giants. And, you know, and then the Nephilim in the Bible. So I want to know, when you talk about giants, what do you really mean? What exactly do you mean? Are we dealing with biblical groups, post-flood people, or simply very tall humans?
Well, that's a great question. And the word giant is, of course, a relative term, right? You know, some people would look, if you're a pygmy in Africa, you might look at me and think I'm a giant. You know, of course, I stand next to some of these NBA players. I would call them giants. But what we're talking about really are the giants in the Bible, and then how that ties in with some of the historical and scientific evidence. And, you know, guys, we read through the Bible. I'm a Christian. You guys are Bible-believing Christians. We read through the Bible, and sometimes our eyes just kind of pass over verses. And until I began to study it out, I didn't realize how much the Bible talks about giants. It's all over the place in the Old Testament. And so this is something that is very interesting, and I think your audience is going to enjoy how the history and the science just all fits together and confirms exactly what God's word says. So if you're all right with it, why don't we dive into our presentation and we'll start talking about the giants a little bit.
Yeah, absolutely. Great. And just so you know, I did a little bit of research before the show, Dave, and I have two, maybe three dozen biblical references to giants or clans of giants, families of giants, incidents involving giants, almost all in the Old Testament. But there are even a couple of references in the New Testament. So let's hear it, Dave. I'm on the edge of my seat.
Well, let's talk about it. So here's a little bit of why this, I think, is important. It's obviously interesting. It's fascinating. But I was wrong initially in my approach and thinking it didn't have anything to do with the origins debate. If you were to take the origins debate and kind of take both models, the creation model and the evolution model, and boil it down to a couple of three key points, we would say it's origin by design versus natural origin, right? That's a pretty big difference. And then you have this concept of decreasing order. That is, in the creation model, God made things good, and at best, they've held level. At worst, they degenerate. They go downhill. On the evolution model, you've got to get from molecules to man. If you're not, then you need to have a creator somewhere. So there has to be an increase in order. It has to be goo to you via the zoo. And then on the creation model, there's catastrophism. Of course, the Genesis flood forming the great geological formations. And on the evolution model, long eons of time, uniformitarian gradualism. So I'd been talking about these two models for a long time, but where the giants fit is right there on that second point. When we look at people and organisms that were bigger in the past, that is evidence for the creation model. And so we'll develop this a little bit more as we go along, but I just want to kind of set the table by saying this is definitely important in the broader origins debate. So three things. We want to talk about the pre-flood Nephilim. We want to talk about the post-flood giant races. And then we'll have a little bit of fun and talk about American mound builders, a civilization called the Mississippian Civilization, the American mound builders. But let's start off with talking about the pre-flood world. And here's a verse that probably a lot of folks are familiar with. This is the first reference to giants in the Bible. And there's a little kind of a rule of biblical interpretation that the first mention of anything in the Bible is really important and kind of sets the foundation biblically for that particular topic. And so this is Genesis chapter 6 and verse 4 is the first mention of giants. And this is just a really fascinating verse that has a number of interesting phrases in it. But let's read it. There were giants in the earth in those days, and also after that, when the sons of God came in unto the daughters of men, and they bare children to them, the same became mighty men, which were of old, men of renown. And this is the Nephilim. People are familiar maybe with the word Nephilim. It's just the old Hebrew word there for giants, these giant people. And so that's obviously a fascinating word. But then we see this phrase, and also after that. And this just is a really significant phrase because it means that this occurred at least twice. There were two important times in biblical history where we had these giants that are going to play just a really key role in biblical history. And then we see this phrase, the sons of God. And there's been some controversy about who exactly these sons of God are. And of course, they marry these daughters of men. And so who are the sons of God and who are the daughters of men? But they have this offspring, which they're mighty men or men of renown. And if we think about historically, who are the men of renown? Who are the people that fill our history books? And guys, it's primarily two groups. There are rulers, there are kings, right? That's, we read a little about lineages of kings. In fact, there's a whole two books of the Bible that are entitled Kings. But then also generals, you know, the Napoleon Bonaparte, the Alexander the Greats, the people that conquer, that build empires, that subdue nations. And so generals and kings probably more than anything else. And so when we think about these giants Okay. The Bible kind of lays this down that they're going to be men of renown. They're going to be men of history, mighty men. And we're going to see that play out as we talk about the giants here in the Bible.
So, Dave, can I ask a quick question? I know there's plenty of Christians who think that this also may have a tie-in with the legend, you know, of the Greek gods. Is that part of your thinking on this? Or I know I've heard that before.
There's a lot of these ancient cultures have traditions of giants. And you could say, well, okay, maybe it's just, you know, coincidence. Maybe they're just kind of inventing gods. And of course, the gods have to be big. And so, they're, you know, they're going to have these giants. I think there's more to it than that. I think this is something that's well known in the ancient world. As Noah comes off the ark, this isn't that long after this Genesis 6 event. It's just literally just right before the flood. And so his descendants carry these stories of giants, really throughout the ancient world. And then, as we're going to see, there is a second instance where these giants play a huge role. Either the sons of God and daughters of men happen again, or somehow just genetically. But these giants are going to be, the Nephilim are going to play a second major role. But let's talk for just a minute about the sons of God, because this is something that there's been some disagreement on. And I'm not going to land on just one interpretation, but I do want to mention all three interpretations of this, this idea of who are these sons of God. And so three common interpretations. The first is that I'm going to mention is the royalty view. And this is actually the newest. This goes back probably to the time of the Reformation or so. But the royalty view says that these sons of God are a dynasty of kings. They considered themselves to be divine. They considered themselves to be sons of God. They fancied themselves to be sons of God. They weren't in any unusual sense. They just were people, but they were this dynasty of kings, very powerful, and they would take these huge harems. And so where they take the daughters of man, the only significance the royalty view would say is that they're just taking a huge harem. And this view, like I say, it's been popular. It's the most recent view of it, but it really fails to explain why there would be giants. That doesn't really explain why they would have these really unusual offspring. And some might say, well, they just fancied themselves to be God and they became rulers as well. Yeah, but that word Nephilim, it really is that they are giants. They're huge people. That is the best interpretation of that. The second view is the Sethite view, and this one's older, goes all the way back at least to St. Augustine, but to the time of the early church. And this view says that there was two lines that stayed pretty distinct. There was the wicked line of Cain, and then after Cain kills Abel, we read that Adam and Eve have this son Seth, and the Bible says men began to call upon the name of the Lord. So it would seem that some of the descendants of Seth maybe were a more godly type, and so if there were some men in Seth's line that kind of looked over at this other wicked group and said, hey, there's some good-looking girls there, and took some of these daughters of Cain, you might say that, well, why doesn't the Bible say daughters of Cain as opposed to daughters of men, which is a much more general phrase? So that's kind of a problem for the Sethite view. But the Sethite view might explain, because of genetic diversity, why they might be a little bit larger. Because if you had a lot of inbreeding in these two lines and now you're bringing in that genetic diversity, perhaps it might do a better job explaining that. The third view is the oldest view, and this is the view that was taken by the Jews all through the years. And this is called the fallen angel view. And this is the belief that there were angels, demons really, who took on human form and they married daughters of men. So they married women, earthly women, and they were able to produce offspring, kind of this hybrid offspring with this angelic seed, and these became these monsters, these Nephilim, these giants. And that view, as I say, was the view of the Jews, and even at the time of the apostles and most of the people in the early church took that view. So that is the oldest view, this fallen angel view.
Well, that's fascinating, because Doug and I always learn something new on this show. If you asked me, I would have guessed number three, the fallen angel view, was the newest. It, you know, because it's it's the one that kind of gets more sensationalized. But that is super interesting that this is actually the oldest view that has Jewish traditions to it, even back to the time of Christ. That's really interesting, Dave.
Yeah, and the Book of Enoch kind of talks a lot about the sons of God. And of course, it's apocryphal, right? It's not inspired, but it does talk a lot about these Nephilim. They figure prominently in the Book of Enoch. There's been a resurgence of this fallen angel view. There's a particular book out that's actually helped in that regard. It's a book by Tim Chafee called Fallen, and it really talks about the Nephilim. So if some of your viewers might want to look into it, it's a very thick book on it, but it talks a lot about this, the Nephilim and this whole interpretation. Now, some people might say, now, wait a minute, isn't this just a little crazy? Like, how can demons take on human form? How could they cohabit with women? And so it, in some ways, it's a little bit of a challenge because they're spirits, right? Angels are spirits. But there is a reference in the book of Jude to there being some angels that did something. And it's in the context of talking about the flood. And so this term sons of God is often used to describe angels in the book of Job. And but then also in Jude, we have this particular verse, Jude chapter, well, there's only one chapter, chapter 1, verse 6. And the angels, which kept not their first estate, but left their own habitation, he hath reserved in everlasting chains under darkness unto the judgment of that great day. So what did these angels do? We don't know for sure. It doesn't say. But they left their own habitation. They left where they should be dwelling and took on some kind of a different habitation, and they did something that was so bad that God doesn't allow them to do the normal demonic thing. They don't go around and, you know, tempt people and do what normal demons do, even inhabit people, possess people and stuff. No, they're actually in a particular chains. They're like in a jail. They're imprisoned until the day of judgment. They don't have any liberty at all. So they did something. And it's, again, in that context of the flood. Again, I'm not going to land on any one view, but I want to mention all three views. And as I say, that third view, the angelic view, is the oldest and has seen a bit of a resurgence lately. So let's talk about giants, right? So we have this Nephilim. You know, how big are they? Well, again, I say the word giant is relative. So they would be bigger than even the people in the pre-flood world. I mentioned earlier that I've been to Africa and the pygmies look at me like I'm a giant. If I stand next to some of these tall NBA players, I would look at them as giants. By the way, the tallest guy ever to play pro ball was a guy named Sun Mingming. He's a Chinese player who was recruited by the Harlem Globetrotters in 2007, and he was 7'9". So about an 8-foot guy. Now that's a tall guy. Here's a picture of Sun Mingming playing on a Chinese basketball league. Mm-hmm. And boy, I wouldn't want to be the guy trying to block this fella. He's just enormous, just very, very tall.
Yeah, that picture you're showing, he's almost twice the size of the guy guarding him. That would be a tough task. Yeah,
he's a tall player. Now, he's not the tallest guy on record. When we think about Guinness Book World Records, we have guys that are even taller. But these folks had a disease that's called giantism. I mean, maybe you guys are familiar with it, but it's a malfunction at the pituitary gland called hypertrophy. And what happens is basically, we all have this growth spurt, right, where we, you know, hit puberty and it kind of levels out and we don't grow that much more after that. But these folks, they never stop. They just keep growing and growing and growing, and it's a disease. It's called giantism. And so this is a little different from the biblical giants we're going to talk about, where you have whole clans of giants and it's a genetic thing. And it's, of course, different from somebody like Sun Mingming, who's very athletic. These people with giantism are sick people. They have problems with their joints. They have problems with their heart. They have a lot of issues, but they'll get very, very big. And so when we look at Guinness Book World Record, it's Robert Wadlow. He's not 8. He's 8'11", almost 9 feet tall. And so here I am standing at Ripley's Believe It or Not next to a mock-up of Robert Wadlow. Guy had a 37 AA shoe, but he's, wow. Here's a picture of him. Alton, Illinois. There's his home, and you can see him. But, you know, look at his siblings. They're all normal size. Look at his dad and mom. They're normal sized. But Robert just towers over them. Even as a young man, he was just really, really tall. But again, these guys don't live real long. Robert, you know, didn't even live into his 30s. He just died young. He had to have braces on his feet. Nice guy, but very sick. He's a sick man. And so these giants in the past are different. These giants in the past, we read about them being warriors and being just these really strong guys, people that can do warfare. And it's not just people, okay? This is the sneaky little secret of the fossil record. Okay, evolutionists don't talk about this much. But all the organisms that are fossilized, this is pre-flood organisms that were fossilized, are bigger, healthier, and lived longer than today's organisms. So yeah, people are living hundreds of years in the pre-flood world, but these organisms are all getting much bigger. And there's been a decline in giant organisms due to genetic mutations and environmental degradation. But this whole fact, truth, reality, that organisms were bigger in the past, giant organisms in the past, fits in really well with the creation model as opposed to the evolution model. See, evolutionists want you to think that primitive is smaller. No, no, no. That's just not true. Primeval was larger. You had monster millipedes, behemoth bunnies, stupendous sharks, guinea pigs the size of rhinoceroses, and rhinoceroses as tall as three-story buildings. So everything was bigger, healthier, and lived longer in the past. But even among their large peers on the early Earth, the Nephilim stood out, and they were deemed giants. They were exceptionally big and tall. So if most people were larger in the pre-flood world, how tall were the Nephilim? And the truth is, we don't know. We just don't know. Do we have any bones from the Nephilim, any fossilized bones? Again, nothing that we can absolutely for sure put a stick in the ground and say, yeah, here's one. Okay, I've got a degree in biology and I'm a scientist. And I'll mention something here, but I'm going to tell you that be cautious with this stuff. In the 1960s, a construction crew in Turkey ran into an ancient burial ground. Engineer reportedly found giant fossilized human bones, and they had this 47-inch femur. A friend of mine, Joe Taylor, he's passed on now, but Joe famously modeled this, and he scaled it up and figured this fellow would have been 14 feet or taller. Supposedly, some similar bones have been found in the Middle East. So 14 feet, maybe, possibly. We got some reports, anecdotal evidence that might be pre-flood Nephilim remains. But again, I would say just be cautious with this. Be cautious.
Well, Dave, just on that topic, we do have considerable fossil evidence that I'm convinced are pre-flood organisms.
Yeah, most everything fossilized is.
Right, right. But do we have fossilized evidence of all the organisms? Probably not.
No.
And so what are the odds that the human creature, the human being, that we just haven't found any of those yet? Or we have found fossilized human remains. There's no doubt about that.
Right.
But we haven't found the giants, which would have been a very small subset of the human beings before the flood. And so just I'm just kind of talking it through. Statistically, it's not unusual that we haven't found any of those yet if there weren't very many of them.
Right, right. So we don't have any even for sure pre-flood human remains. We do have fossilized humans, but this is, I mean, people can be fossilized today. I mean, fossilization's more rare today, but it happens, right? And we do have some fossilized humans that are possibilities. You know, you've got Malachite Man, you've got the Guadalupe skeletons. I talk about these on my website, genesispark.com. But again, I'm tenuous.
Good stuff. Good stuff. Because I like to clarify things for the audience because there's so much that I don't know. It helps me. So we don't know that we have pre-flood human beings. It sounds like you would lean toward we probably don't, or at least we don't know.
Yeah, we don't know. That's the bottom line. I put some candidates on my website, and people ask, "Well, okay, how come we don't have these?" And it's a valid question, and it might just be, you know, God's purpose for that flood. The purpose for the flood was to destroy that wicked pre-flood civilization. That was the whole point. So perhaps God allowed the fountains of the great deep just to really erupt there, and it just pulverized all those people. Perhaps people were smart enough to get to the high ground, and they weren't covered with the waves that carried the debris that covered a lot of the animals. And so they just became fish food, right? Or they drowned and just deteriorated. Perhaps the area that was the Garden of Eden and where these guys are buried and where any fossilized remains might be is in Antarctica. And so it's all in the deep freezer under a mile of ice. So there's a lot of possibilities here. And the short answer is we don't know why we don't have more. Maybe we'll find some. Maybe we'll find a whole bunch someday. But then if you do find them, what are the odds of them actually being Nephilim? I mean, it might be that they're just the normal people, which might still be bigger. I mean, maybe they're 10 feet is normal, you know, and then the Nephilim are, you know, 14 or 16 feet tall. I don't know.
Mm. Yeah.
I'm speculating at this point.
Yeah, and I think if people understand that the odds of finding, even, you know, mammalized fossil bones, when you find a dinosaur bone or any kind of mammal, it's worth money because they're so rare. I remember seeing a graph for like 99.5 of the fossil record, 99.5% is marine life. And that's something that's just more easily going to be buried in the type of global catastrophe that we saw. And humans, like you said, would be able to, you know, they would be able to seek higher ground. They're going to get washed out. They're not going to fossilize. So for me, it would be pretty amazing to ever find fossilized humans. It's possible, but it's more unlikely. People need to understand that the fossil record really is a testimony to judgment that really buried a ton of marine life, and it would have been pretty hard. And I'm sure there are humans that were buried somewhere, but the odds of finding them are so low.
Right.
Maybe we will someday.
Good points. Good points. Yeah, well, let's talk about the post-flood giant races, because guys, we know a lot more about these. This is where it gets kind of interesting. Giants didn't just appear in the pre-flood world. They appeared again very prominently after the time of the Exodus. So you think about Noah, Shem, Ham, and Japheth, of course, Shem, and then eventually Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. So we're going, you know, multiple generations. We're going centuries down from the flood. Jacob's descendants would be then in Egypt for, you know, a number of years, again, generations. And then they're coming out of Egypt, and all of a sudden they encounter this group of warlike giants in the region of Canaan, especially a group called the Anakim. Now, it seems that they were named after a particular fella, a particular giant named Anak. And we've got the names of several of these giants. You know, people think of Goliath. Okay, yeah, but you got Arba and Anak, and, you know, there's others here that we got several of the names of these different giants. And we'll talk about more as we go. But there's one guy who's Arba, and Arba seems to be like maybe a father of a clan of giants. And his most famous son is Anak. And so, in Hebrew, when you want to make something plural, you add an I-M ending. In English, if we want to make something plural, we add S. So let's say we got a couple of guys named Fred that are sitting over there. We would say the Freds are sitting in the front row. Okay, if you're in Hebrew, you would say the Fredim. Fredim are sitting in the front row. So when we think of Anakim, okay.
I like Fredakim nearly better. I think that would come up.
Yeah, but they're not giants.
Fredakim.
So Anakim is just the plural. Okay. It's just kind of his famous son, Anak, kind of becomes the name of all this clan or this tribe. And you see, I got a number of references here. We're not going to have time to go through them all. But once you start looking for them, these giants are all over the place. Here's just an example. In Numbers 13:33, the children of Israel are coming back from reporting on the land. They're reporting on what they see. They kind of go walking through the land of Canaan. They bring back the grapes. And of course, they're excited. The land is fruitful and beautiful. But they say, the people that we saw in it are men of great stature. There we saw the giants, that Hebrew word Nephilim, the two sons of Anak, which come of the giants. And we were in our own sight as grasshoppers, and so we were in their sight. Now, guys, these are not just head and shoulders over them, okay? Saul was head and shoulders over anybody in Israel. Nobody called him a giant. These guys are serious big. Now, I'm sure that, you know, they're exaggerating, right? That's not quite a grasshopper to human proportions, but these guys are monsters. And the children of Israel are frightened. They are really, really scared to the point that they rebel against God and refuse to enter the promised land that they were so excited about because of these frightening giants. Now, Israel had already seen warfare previously, and so they wouldn't have been easily intimidated, but these giants had to be really big and really numerous for them to say, no, we can't go in. In fact, let's just go back to the land of Egypt. This is a hopeless cause. So these guys are monsters.
And I'd like to say, if you think about just growing up as a kid, being in the world, you get used to the genetic diversity that we see in people. We see a lot of big people, smaller people, a wide range. It's not going to be any different for the Jewish people, for the nation of Israel. So that's where that always stuck out to me, is like, why is there this extra emphasis on these being, you know, giants as compared to, like, we see football players. We know they're really big men, but we don't just all of a sudden say, hey, man, I was around a bunch of giants. So that's kind of what struck me.
Yeah, unless you're a New York fan, and in which case you would say that. But no, you're right. Here's another verse, Joshua 15:8. And the border went up to the top of the mountains that lies before the valley of Hinnom westward, which is at the end of the valley of the giants northward. Again, guys, this is not a freak situation like Robert Wadlow, where somebody's, you know, got giantism. Okay, and we're going to stick him up there because he's going to be intimidating, but he really can't hardly move. we're just going to use him as kind of the mascot. No, no, this is clans of giants, okay? The giants occupy this whole valley, tribes of giants. And the Anakim aren't the only ones. I mean, they're one, and they're probably the most famous one, and they would eventually be driven out by Joshua. When Joshua would go into the land and they would believe God, the giants are still there, and Joshua and Caleb drive them out. But it seems they don't kill them all. It seems they don't kill all the Anakim. Some of the Anakim flee the armies under Joshua, and they go to the seacoast. Now, Joshua conquers the hill country. He conquers down towards the Negev, but he never conquers the Philistine area there in the Shualah, the sea region, the seacoast, the kind of the low hills there. And so here we have, you know, these Gaza, Gath, Ekron, Ashdod, the various cities of the Philistines, and they don't get conquered, and the Anakim hide out there. And so we read in Joshua 11:22, there was none of the Anakims left in the land of the children of Israel, only in Gaza, Gath, and Ashdod there remained. So these are all Philistine cities, and it seems they can kind of see the handwriting on the wall, and the Anakim get out. And the Philistines are happy to give them sanctuary and say, hey, you know what, we could stand some of these big giants here on our side. And so they end up hanging out with the Philistines. Now, besides the Anakim, there's another tribe.
Wait. Hide that slide. Quick, don't read it, Doug.
Oh, my bad. Okay, we're back.
Well, you're stealing my interesting fact of the week. And I mentioned to Doug off air that this one's gonna probably be one that's a little bit easier. But I thought you were gonna come to that slide, Dave. So
okay,
I gotta have. Well,
Doug, so I didn't see the slide, Fred, and I thought we had made it through the show and I was going to get by with one show.
Nope, not so lucky, Doug, but I think you got a decent shot at this one.
All right, lay it on me.
Okay, so this is the interesting fact of the week. Deuteronomy gives the dimensions of King Og's iron bed.
Ooh.
Doug, how long was it in modern feet?
In modern feet.
Modern feet.
Okay, if I'm not mistaken, who was it again?
King Og.
Og of Bashan. Yes.
That's it.
I think it was nine.
Oh man!
So hold on, I have to think. I have to think in Hebrew
terms. Your buzzer,
for just
get your
a
buzzer,
second.
Get your
no,
buzzer
no, no, no,
ready
no.
there, Fred.
So it was twelve feet.
Okay.
Yeah. So, Dave, do you know? And I won't. I don't buzz my guest.
Yeah. We do. In fact, that is the next slide. So, okay. It's a great segue. Thank you, Fred. But let me mention before we get to Og, let me mention the Rephaim. Okay. Now, the Rephaim is a whole nother tribe. Okay. You got the Anakim. They got their valley, right? You got all these different children of Arba and Anak. Okay. This is a whole nother group called the Rephaim, and they live in the northeast. They live up in the hill country close to the Jordan River Valley. And that mentions that over the Nephaim, that they were strong and tall like the Anakim, but over them was this King Og. By the way, Fred, isn't that a great name for a giant?
It is.
It's just awesome. I mean, I could just see him walking into the room, and I'm saying, "Hi, I'm Dino D." And he's saying, "Hey, I'm Og." It's a great name for a giant. So King Og of Bashan, he's described as the last of the Rephaim, and he had this iron bed, as Fred said. And the bed, okay, guys, ready, is 14 feet long and 6 feet wide.
Oh, okay. Well, hold on now. I need to file an official protest. No, not an official pro. Anyway, so I was thinking of the 9 cubits, which, yes, you know, there's the royal cubit, and then there. No, I'm just kidding.
No.
I had it wrong.
But how big is Og? We don't know for sure, but we would estimate they're not going to waste a lot of iron in those days, right? And so, you know, maybe you got a foot to spare on either side. He'd be about 12 feet tall. And his bed was so significant that they put it on display, Deuteronomy 3:11, for subsequent generations to see. And here's just kind of a little mock-up of Dino Dave laying in. I mean, you could lay sideways, right? Like, you could lay a whole bunch of people sideways in Og's bed.
and Dave, just to be clear, the Bible states that the bed was on display. The bed wasn't put on display like we found out about that in secular history. That's in the Bible.
Yes, that's right.
Oh, that's really interesting. I'm sorry, guys. I should buzz myself. I thought when you said it was put on display, I'm thinking of a museum somewhere. I didn't realize the Bible actually says it was put on display.
Yes.
Wow.
Yeah, they kept it around because, you know, they probably buried Og. But, you know, this was just kind of like a memento of what they'd accomplished to have killed this guy. This guy's a monster. He's just enormous. Now, what would it be like to face a 12-foot-tall person in battle in a day of hand-to-hand combat? And I did this talk at a camp a couple summers ago, and we got this 12-foot skeleton. It was so awesome. We had it just behind the curtain. And at this point in the slide, I would say, we have a 12-foot skeleton, and we would push it, the guys would roll it out, and the kids would all gasp because, I mean, I can barely touch this guy's pelvic. Like, I'm just kind of to his hip. This guy, I'm 5'9", right? I'm less than half this guy's height. And can you imagine, like, you've got a sword and a spear, and you're trying to do battle against a guy that's twice as high as you. And yeah, I felt like a grasshopper, right? And so this is pretty amazing that these armies under Joshua can take a guy like this out. And it probably took more than one guy to take him out, right? They probably had to surround the guy. But these guys would be really intimidating, right? 12 foot would be really, really intimidating. And the giants are not restricted right there to Canaan. The Bible records other races of giants in the Middle East. You don't just have the Anakim and the Rephaim. You got the Emim, the Horim, the Avims, the Zamzamims. That's a great name, isn't it? Zamzamims, man. Watch out for them. And these are killed off by other nations, the Moabites, the Edomites, and stuff. So these are multiple races. Again, I tell you, it's not a freak genetic anomaly. It's not Robert Wadlow. These guys are whole races whole tribes, whole clans that are through that Middle East region that are at the time of the Exodus. Now, that's Bible, right? And of course, we believe it because it's Bible and that's enough for us. But do we have historical records? Do we have extra biblical references to these giants? And the answer is yes, we do. We have historical reference to some of these tribes. For example, it talks about in Deuteronomy 2, the Emims. The Emims dwelt there in the time past, people great and tall as the Anakims, which also were accounted giants. Mm. And so these giants are rulers. They're celebrated. They're godlike heroes there in the Middle East. And the stories and even the depictions of them are a matter of historical record. For example, here is an ancient, thousands of years old depiction of Marduk of old Sumer. He's the king, right? And look at this guy. I mean, they're barely going up to his thigh. Now, again, it might be a little exaggerated. Maybe they're trying to make Marduk out to be a little bit, you know, more grand than even he was, but clearly a giant, right? In comparison. Here is the Mesopotamian hero Gilgamesh. And of course, we have the Epic of Gilgamesh, the stories of him, but also these depictions of Gilgamesh. And he was so strong, he could crush a lion, and he was called the King of Uruk in this first post-flood city. And supposedly, he stood 12 feet tall, but you can see him in comparison to the lion. He's just enormous.
You know, Dave, that's really interesting that when you think about artistic depictions of world leaders, national leaders, especially when they commission the art to glorify themselves, it's quite often they are made to look more spectacular, more marvelous, and more good looking, maybe, than they were.
Yeah.
But to make them so much more enormous, it does seem to point to, and especially since there's more than one of these out there, it does seem to point to the idea that many of the rulers of the ancient world were these giants, and many of the gods that would later be worshipped by the pagan nations are more than likely based on some of these personalities, these giant personalities from the antediluvian world and then perhaps even afterwards. Very, very fascinating stuff.
Now, some people would object, and you mentioned this, Doug, a minute ago, that, okay, these drawings, these sculptings are commissioned by kings who want to make themselves look like gods, make themselves look bigger than life. And so can we really trust that? Can we really think that this is actual historical evidence of giants, or is it just mere propaganda? And I want to mention a particular relief. This is from the land of Egypt. It's from the ancient Egyptian dynasties going back to 1274. And the Egyptians have records of giants, but it's not their pharaoh. It's giants in Canaan. And so they, in conquering the region, they are going up and doing battle in the region of Canaan, and they run into these giants, and they call them Shazu. And in particular, there's this really fascinating relief, this drawing at the temple of Abu Simbel. And this carving shows the Egyptians encountering these Shazu, these giants. They capture a couple of them at the Battle of Kadesh in 1274, and the Egyptians are beating up giants. So this isn't a matter of glorifying their pharaoh. There is legit these giants. And so you see the Egyptians, and they're standing on either side of these two Shazu. And the Shazu are about as tall as, sitting down, are about as tall as the Egyptians who are beating them up, standing up. So at least 9 feet tall. At least 9 feet tall. And that's right there in Abu Simbel, still to this day.
So, Dave, let me ask a quick question before I forget. So,
yeah,
in your opinion, are these post-flood giants, would they be fallen angels? In your opinion, I know that we wouldn't really know for sure, but...
Yeah, we don't know for sure. So the people that take the fallen angel view would tend to think that there was this second cohabitation. So pre-flood, You have the cohabitation, which causes this wicked offspring, right? It's this corrupt offspring, this hybrid offspring. And the folks that would hold to the angel, fallen angel view would say, well, this is Satan and his demons trying to corrupt the seed. You know, God promised the seed's going to crush your head. And so they want to corrupt the seed. And so this is their little plot. And so they make a move, okay? Think of like a chess match in history, right? And so the demonic armies make a move, and they have these Nephilim, and God makes a move, and it's called the flood, and God destroys them all. And so they see all their progeny, all that they've worked for, destroyed in the flood. And then after the flood, again, this would be for the people that take the angel view, they would hold to this. God chooses Abraham, and God said, it's going to be your seed. It's going to be your offspring, Abraham. And of course, Satan hears this and says, okay, so guess what's waiting for Abraham's offspring when they come up out of the land of Egypt? Mm. Whole bunch of giants. Satan's been back at his little game again.
Right.
And if you understand that, all of a sudden something makes sense. Why does God say you need to destroy every man, woman, and child in Canaan? They all have to die. Why that severe?
Yes, yes. Yeah. And Dave, another piece of evidence is that the second instance of this gigantic race occurs in the land that God promised to Abraham. So it seems, or at least that's evidence, that this satanic plot went after, since they couldn't go after Abraham's seed, they went after the land.
So right.
Just another piece of evidence. Again, not there. There's no slam dunk, but interesting, really interesting stuff.
Well, and if this is what happened, if there was this second cohabitation and you had a demonic activity going on before Israel gets there and these tribes have established themselves in the land, then that would be why God says, wipe out every single man, a woman, and child, right? Genocide, get rid of them all. And that would be then when God takes these angels that were part of this plot and say, okay, we're all done, no more of this, and puts them in some kind of a spirit prison, as is mentioned in the book of Jude. Again, I'm not saying it's absolute, that is the only interpretation. There's questions about all the interpretations, you know, including how do angels, which are spirits, produce human sperm? I mean, that is a legitimate question. We do read about angels, demonic activity, the magicians able to produce frogs and things in Egypt. So maybe there is some ability for them to produce biological material. Just don't know. So it's speculation. But one of the things we do know is that these giants had six fingers and six toes. This is common. We see it mentioned multiple times in the Bible, in 2 Samuel 21, for example. It's a condition called polydactyly. It's still known today. Here's a fellow from Cuba, and you can see this is not Photoshop. This is true to life. This guy's got six fingers, and people asked him, what was it like growing up with six fingers? And this Cuban young man said, well, I was able to climb the coconut trees faster than any of the other boys to get the coconuts. So these were all active fingers, and it was to his advantage. But this is something that we read about. It's quite common with the giants.
Well, Doug, you're a guitar player. Would that help you to have, you know, play a 12-string guitar? You'd already have half.
Yeah,
you do it.
You pluck
all
a
of it better. You're doing the whole picking.
You play piano, you get some really rich chords, right?
There you go.
Well, guys, all right, it's time. We got to talk about the most famous giant of all time, right? Here is a reconstruction of the ancient city of Gath. And of course, you can see the Mediterranean Sea there in the distant horizon. But it would be in these low hills called the Shuela there in what's today Israel. And in the area of Gath, Gaza area today, you would have this city, and it's giving refuge to Anakim. And Goliath is a descendant of those Anakim. And we know how tall Goliath is because it specifically gives us his measurements, and he's 10 feet tall.
We'll stop here, but don't miss next week as we look further into the notorious 10-foot giant Goliath and other remarkable information about giants.